Welcome back to the program. Many have spoken of the structural problems we face in our economy and in our democracy. Individually, our broken financial system, the power of money in politics, our failure to meet the global challenges of 21st century education, and our decaying infrastructure are all very real problems. But collectively, what do these problems and the degree to which they've been neglected for so long tell us about our society, our values, and what it means to be a citizen of this country? Have we in fact reached a tipping point where failure to address these will result in what Tom Friedman calls a very bad century for America? This is the starting point for Jeffrey Sachs' sweeping look at the state of our not-so-great society as he looks at the price of civilization. Jeffrey Sachs is the director of the Earth Institute and professor of sustainable development and health policy and management at Columbia University. He's a special advisor to UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon on the Millennial Development Goals, and it is my pleasure to have Jeffrey Sachs back on this program to talk about his newest work, The Price of Civilization, Reawakening American Virtue and Prosperity. Jeffrey Sachs, thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Great to have you here. As we look at some of the problems that have led us to where we are today, is it just a matter of bad policy choices along the way, or do these policy choices somehow reflect a deeper set of decaying values?
I think that the good news is that one can still find good evidence that American values in the mainstream are intact. But one also finds a lot of evidence that our politics are broken, and that the division between what Americans would like and what we are actually doing as a nation is farther apart than at any time in our modern history. So I found, as I was writing this book and was indeed very, very deeply concerned about the state of American values, because I find a society that has become very unfair, even lawless on Wall Street and reckless in behavior and paralyzed in Washington, or so it seems, I thought that maybe this was fully a deterioration of the on-the-ground mainstream situation. I have to say I was relieved to find that Americans still today espouse values of compassion, values of mutual responsibility. They want a government that functions. There isn't nihilism, but there is a lot of despair. There is some measure of cynicism, and there's a lot of pessimism, and that is unusual for us as a country, and it is, of course, extraordinarily worrisome.
There is the old adage, of course, that we tend to get the government we deserve, and in many ways we have elected leaders who have reinforced some of these policies that we're talking about.
Well, we do have now a record, and this is at the core of my analysis, that 30 years of governments from both parties that have essentially not faced the real challenges that a globalized economy poses for America. We've had 30 years of governments that have more or less catered to the wealthy, that have more or less deregulated industries from their responsibilities in health, in finance, in the environment. We have governments that have been slashing social services, not the headline big programs like Medicare and Social Security, but the programs for job training, for education, for tuition coverage, from Pell Grants, from environmental programs, from investment in infrastructure. That's been going on for 30 years, what you could call the government investments and public services. And whether Democrat or Republican, unfortunately, this trend has persisted to the point where Americans don't really believe in the competence or even honesty of the government anymore, and they forget a bit what it's like to have a government that's on their side. Most Americans respond in opinion surveys to the idea that Washington is actually not our government so much as a special interest in its own right, which is a horrible thought, perhaps accurate, but a horrible thought for a democracy.
In your view, how did we get to this point?
I think that many things have brought us here. I start with the economics, naturally, as an economist. The 1970s ushered in a new age of globalization. We started feeling the heightened competition from Japan, then from other Asian economies like Korea or Taiwan, then, of course, the big one, China. And with that heightened global competition, a lot of our manufacturing sector closed down, shifted abroad. We produced more and more goods in China and other emerging economies. Incomes for high school men, high school graduates, male in particular, stagnated starting in the mid-1970s. There hasn't actually been an increase in the median earnings of full-time male workers for 38 years in this country. Now, all the gains went to the top because globalization was a favor to those with big money who could respond to larger markets, could move their money abroad, and so on. Normally, a government would have done something to say, well, here's a trend. Maybe overall it's positive, but it sure is hurting a part of our society. Let's help those who are being hurt. Let's make sure that our young people get the training they need to be productive and competitive in this new world economy. But our government did nothing of the sort, and that is the puzzle that I try to understand. Ronald Reagan came to office January 1981 with the explanation in his mind that that government is not the solution to our problems. Government is the problem. An amazing, destructive sentiment, in my view. It put us on a 30-year path of antagonism to government, of antagonism to paying the price of civilization through decent taxation. Of course, Reagan did more than that. He cut the tax rates for the rich. He slashed public services and public investments for the rest of society. He deregulated the financial markets. He busted the unions. And he set the U.S. on a course where government was amplifying rather than reducing the inequalities of income. But what's puzzling about all of this, I think, to me, and what requires yet another layer of explanation, is that this persisted through George H.W. Bush Sr., through Bill Clinton, through George W. Bush Jr., and really through the first 3 years of the Obama administration. They've all been on a path of keeping the top tax rates low, letting the hedge fund guys get by with a 15% top tax rate. All of our presidents till the financial crash were in favor of deregulating the banks. Bill Clinton led the undoing of Glass-Steagall, which was a protection against conglomerates like Citigroup that would gamble with the base of commercial banking and infuse kind of casino tactics into the banking sector. And that was a Democratic administration. Republicans did the same. So this has been going on for 30 years. My best estimate, I don't think it's a shocking view in any way, but my best estimate is that basically both political parties have been chasing big money, big campaign contributors, lobbying at around $4 billion a year, federal elections, which cost now about $6 billion each cycle, mean that our politicians are attuned, they have their antennae out for the rich. And the rest of us have been forgotten. I think the Occupy Wall Street crowd has it just right when they say we are the 99%. What they're saying is, hey, what about us? Why just the top 1% in American power?
And while there is all this talk, though, about tax policy and the various metrics that we're discussing, the reality is that we have not heard from anyone, really, a specific plan that addresses exactly what you referred to before as some kind of plan to be able to address these larger issues like globalization in the context of the reality of what's happening and how we can best adjust our society to deal with those things.
I think that's exactly right, and that's what's so worrisome. On the Republican side, they continue to channel Reagan in the message, let's just slash more taxes at the top, let's cut the tax rates further, and let's slash government at the bottom, or not even at the bottom, for everybody. Ron Paul wants to eliminate the Department of Education entirely. Rick Perry says he wants to cut it in half. That'll be great, a country with even less educational attainment than we have right now, just as we're falling farther and farther behind the leading countries in the world. So that's the Republican side, which is, in my view, diametrically in the wrong direction. The Democratic side is a kind of intellectual disconnect, it seems to me, because I like the first half of most of President Obama's speeches. He talks about reinvesting in our future. But then the second half is always about budget cutting. And so we have a disconnect. And the most that the president has done is short-term stimulus, not long-term investment. And what I recommend in my book is a long-term investment strategy. It's going to take us a decade or more to rebuild, to enable half or more of our kids to finish a four-year bachelor's degree, to be training for higher manufacturing skills like our manufacturing sector is crying out for right now, machinists and systems engineers and craftsmen and so forth. This is going to take time. A stimulus can't do it. And I say we have to pay for it by taxing the rich again, because they've walked away with the prize. They've carried off the lion's share of the increases of national income during the last generation. They have accumulated vast wealth. I say let's tax wealth above $5 million net worth per household. Let's tax the top income brackets at a higher rate. Let's close down the corporate loopholes that allow corporate profits to be taxed at zero tax rates in Bermuda and the Cayman Islands. Let's enforce our tax laws and stop the flagrant tax evasion, which loses at least a couple percent of gross national product in tax revenues. I say that we should get somewhere on the order of 4 or 4.5 percentage points of our national income in higher taxes at the top and in the corporate sector. And this could pay for the rest of society, an education system, a modernized infrastructure, a serious approach to energy policy and to environmental sustainability. So that's the kind of program that I'm sketching out in the book. But it's not on offer from either political party. Both political parties are in a direction of shrinking government more, and I think leaving America even more exposed to very tough and treacherous international waters right now.
When we look at this in the context of even the congressional elections, the midterm elections 1 year ago, the American people seem to be moving, in at least in terms of their voting, in precisely the opposite direction.
I think they were expressing a big unhappiness with Obama and with what's happened. And, of course, the Tea Party, boosted by Fox News, was the preeminent public image of the time, and they carried a lot of votes. We know that large right-wing financiers like the Koch brothers were quite successful in backing a lot of candidates, not some of their candidates, but a lot of candidates also at the state level. Definitely 2010 was a swing even further away from what I think is needed. But American politics takes time. And when I look back in history, my reference points are the Progressive Era, the New Deal, the Civil Rights Era. These are examples when the pendulum swung the other way. to more inclusion in American society, to making the rich pay their share, to bringing finance back under lawful control. And I think that we're likely to see that swing in the pendulum in the future. But I have to acknowledge, boy, am I worried right now, because we don't have that kind of approach at the national level yet.
But we don't even have that plan, as we were saying a few moments ago, we don't even have that plan articulated. It's one thing for the pendulum to swing randomly back in the other direction, and historically, that obviously is the historical case that can be made. But without a plan, without a way to deal with these investments, to deal with these issues in the context of a 21st century world, we're just sort of victims of the swinging pendulum and not necessarily making the progress we might be able to make when the movement is in that direction.
I think that's right. And one of the things that I have most complained to my friends in the White House about is that they're not making these plans. And it's not good enough just to have short-term, one-year policies. We need the longer plans. But I think it's also true, I'm not alone in this view that I express in the book and in the sketch that I make. The Congressional Progressive Caucus, the CPC so-called, put out what they called the People's Budget earlier this year, and I worked with them a bit on that. That was a longer-term view of reinvesting in America. There are proposals around, but there hasn't been a politics around it, in part because President Obama chose a shorter-term Keynesian stimulus message, which I think was the wrong one.
Explain why the short-term stimulus doesn't work even in the short run, why it doesn't get us at least off the ground, why there's no lift at all from it.
I think that people know that a tax cut is temporary. They're very worried. They're not going to go out and spend that tax cut on consumer goods again. They're not in the mood to go buy a lot of new houses. They are cautious. And so even when there's a little bit more cash flow, they're putting it into savings or paying down debts, credit card debts. Companies say, well, 1 year, what's that? You know, yeah, you give me a one-year payroll tax cut, but that's not a real invitation to hire more workers. I know that it's temporary. And so I think when everything is so temporary, you don't get the kind of responses that one wants, and people see that we have a big fiscal crisis, so they don't believe in the tax cuts. And the spending increases, of course, in some areas, when it's for desperately needed services, are all fine, but they don't create infrastructure, they don't create a new investment program, and so forth. So I think that this is really the point that President Obama discovered, to his chagrin and surprise, it seems, that there really is no such thing as a shovel-ready infrastructure project. That's what he banked a lot on. But then he actually had to acknowledge later on, well, maybe there wasn't so much that was shovel-ready in the end. We need a longer-term view. We absolutely have to get beyond the short-term election cycle if we're really going to solve any of these problems.
We hear a lot, particularly from the Occupy protesters, about 99%, 1%. In your view as an economist, how wide, how significant is the wealth gap in this country right now?
I think by the best we can measure it, the income gap and the wealth gap are the biggest that they've been since the Great Depression. So we've had the three waves of inequality in modern industrial history. The first was the robber baron era at the end of the 19th century, sometimes called the Gilded Age. Then was the roaring 20s with an era of financial excess and speculation that ended in the stock market crash of 1929. And now this one that started in 1981 and has built up till today, with some automatic correction as stock markets fell after 2008. But I think where we are today is comparable to where we were in earlier peaks of inequality. And we're at levels that provoked massive political change in the past. And I have a sense that that will happen again now.
Jeffrey Sachs. His book is The Price of Civilization, Reawakening American Virtue and Prosperity. Jeffrey, it is always a pleasure. I thank you so much for spending time with us.
Oh, it's a pleasure for me. Anytime. Thank you so much.